High performance without well-being is unsustainable.
Welcome to Peak 40, the podcast that brings you the tips, tactics, and stories for living your best life in midlife. If you're in your mid-30s to 50s, Peak 40 is the place to get actionable advice on the nuances of nutrition, training, recovery, and mindset in midlife. For the full experience and other valuable resources, register for the Peak 40 weekly newsletter at drbubs.com/peak40 to enhance your lifestyle and start making midlife your best life.
Welcome back, or welcome to the Peak 40 podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mark Bubs. This is season number 3, episode 2, and today I've got a tremendous guest for you. Dr. Michael Gervais, high performance psychologist and host of the widely popular Finding Mastery podcast, is on the show. Dr. Gervais has been working in the trenches of high stakes environments with some of the best in the world, training the mindset, skills, and practices essential to pursuing and revealing one's potential. His clients include world record holders, Olympians, internationally acclaimed artists and musicians, MVPs from every major sport, and Fortune 100 CEOs. In this episode, we'll discuss how he discovered his passion for his craft, mental performance, why building mindset skills is a non-negotiable for high performance. Dr. Gervais will discuss his views on anxiety and strategies to cope with this, and much, much more. Lots of great tips and actionable insights in this episode. No doubt, you'll take something away. Before we get started, we've been getting more great feedback from the Peak 40 book over the last few years. So I just wanted to share with you this recent note from a prominent doctor and surgeon. Mark, I had the opportunity to read your Peak 40 book. With so much garbage out there these days, it was refreshing to read a book like this. Simple and easy to understand and fully evidence-based. I'm big into nutrition and I've read a ton of books and literature in this space. Your book was the best I've read so far. Keep up the good work. We need someone like you preaching an evidence-based approach. Appreciate the feedback, Doc, and appreciate all the feedback and reviews coming in. Please do keep sending them over, posting to Amazon and other review areas. It's a great support to the show. All right, let's do this. My conversation with high-performance psychologist, Dr. Michael Gervais.
Michael, really appreciate you carving out some time today for us. I've got a whole list of different topics here I'd love to dive into here today. And I think, you know, to set the stage here, really, I'd love to go back to the beginning of your journey, you know, in terms of mental performance. You know, what got you into mental performance, and how did you know that this, you know, this is it, this is what I want to do?
Okay, first, thanks for including me in your community and what you're doing. I've appreciated your work. So this is a treat for me to be able to swap some stories, and hopefully we have a exchange rather than just a one-way conversation here.
For sure.
Yeah, so it started for me when, this is all looking back. You know, So I didn't know at the time as it was unfolding how it was working, but it's pretty clear looking back is when I was a young athlete, surfing was my first sport of choice. And there's two types of surfing. There's free surfing and competitive surfing. Mm-hmm. And in free surfing, there's a code, you know, and that code was don't talk about it, be about it. Put yourself in the most dangerous wave, you know, of the day and experience that fully. And then don't check to see if anyone's looking. You know, just know that, have this internal knowing. And, you know, it's the quote unquote hardcore approach. And I fit in that. That was cool. And I secretly kind of wanted some people to say that was cool, you know, like, but that culture was great for me. And then flip over to competitive surfing. I wanted to give it a go. And in the hardcore surfing world, it was like, you know, those kooks over there that are competing, they're blowing it for the sport. Like that, you know, they've got it all backwards. They're sponsored and there's stickers on their board and they're doing splashy things. And
yeah,
I wanted to give it a go. And I should set a little more context is that when I was young and I'm talking like in 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, I wasn't exposed to the ocean for surfing. And so I tried, my parents introduced me to stick and ball sport.
Yeah.
And it was obvious. It was like this reaction I had, which was like, what are these adults screaming at us for? And what are all these rules? Who made up these rules? Like, what do you mean if you put your foot on the line, you're out? Like, shit, I got control of the ball. Let's go. You know, so I'm thinking soccer right now. Yeah. So I didn't get these artificial rules and these, you know, these kind of adults screaming at kids. And so I didn't vibe it. And that when I found action sports, skateboarding, surfing, motocross, BMX, I was like, oh, Mother Nature's the teacher. Okay, I got respect. And so back to surfing, as soon as I lent my hand to competitive surfing, I was a disaster, dude. Like all these people on the beach judging me, critiquing me, and like
something else, right?
I couldn't get it right. And I understand now what I understand exactly what was happening, but it was this moment where it was another competitor. He was a few years older than me and he paddled by me. There was just three of us out in the water, clean conditions. It was like 8 a.m. Exactly what you would hope for, about head high waves, super glassy, great conditions.
Nice.
And he paddles by me and he says, "Gervais, I surf with you every day out here. You got to stop worrying about what other people are thinking about you." And I was like, how does he know?
Yeah.
How does he know? You know, like, yeah, how did he knew? Cause he struggled with it probably, you know, you spot it, you got it. And so from that moment, I didn't know what sports psychology was. I didn't know anything, but it kind of hit me, which was like, yeah, my body hasn't changed. My skills are the same as yesterday. The hell? It was my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually that was the age 15. Eventually it set me down this path to really want to understand how the mind works, because we take it everywhere we go. Boardroom, living room, ocean, pitch, field, court, whatever it might be, we take it. And I wanted to get that thing dialed in because it was such a mess. So that's how it started for me.
It's interesting. I mean, I growing up playing a lot of team sports, you know, it's very reactionary. You get into the flow of things. And so you shake off a lot of that. And playing into some individual sports, I started playing golf late in my high school years and started getting into it. And then all of a sudden you played in the tournament, a little bit similar to what you're saying. So now all of a sudden everyone's looking at you rather than just being on the course with your buddies, and all these internal thought, you have so much time to think rather than react and respond. And, you know, if we sort of fast forward to the early stages of your career, are there some moments that stick out with working with athletes, you know, that were particularly challenging at that point, or that really forced you to push yourself outside of that initial comfort zone that we have when we have our training and some of the philosophies we want to lay down, but then that reality of the real world practice, you know, presents roadblocks in itself, right?
Yeah, that's a cool question. No one's ever asked me that before. The what happened early on for me was that right after my graduate training, I needed a job. And so action sports, you know, they weren't hiring. It's a little bit off access, back country, you know. And so so I found myself in pro sport. It was stick and ball. And so
you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. And I didn't quite get it at that time. And they didn't quite, it just wasn't a great fit. So I left after about 5 years pro sport and went, Red Bull fired up a high performance program. And so I was fortunate enough to kind of find a spot in that emerging discipline of sports science inside of action sports. Mm-hmm. And it was great. It was super electric. It was awesome. And so to answer your question, there was a project I worked on called Red Bull Stratos. And so Felix Baumgartner was the athlete who the team built a capsule, and this was an aerospace engineered, you know, project. And they built a capsule, took them up to 130,000 feet, which is up there, you know, and it's 100,000 feet higher than an airliner. And it's kind of the curvature of space. It's right about where you would shoot off to zero gravity into outer space and kind of be out of orbit. There's enough. That part wasn't dangerous, but it was just really high.
Yeah.
And, you know, the project started to skid because he was developing some fear around, you know, the whole thing. And so we did some good, honest work. And that's when, so if you lose a game in stick and ball, you know,
sucks.
Okay. It sucks. Not the end, you know, of the world. But yeah, it's not like it was, I don't know, 200 or 1,000 years ago where the warring tribe took your family, you know, like, that's okay, pressure. That loss, that's a bad loss. That's the worst. That's as bad as it gets, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're captured and you see them taking your kids and your spouse. And so in stick and ball, it's so far from that. And then this one was somewhere in between, which is if he makes mistakes or if we made a mistake.
Could be it.
In our preparation and training, or if somebody on the design capsule, you know, made a mistake, like his life is, you know, at risk. And so that's when I had a moment where I was like, I had to take that leap from science, using good science, grounded, well-tested laboratory science, and then bridge it into an environment that has not been tested in the environment that we were working in. So that bridge there's a leap that happens in there. And that's what would keep me up at night, which is taking good grounded science. One, to get your arms around that, that's a full lift in and of itself. Yeah. And then to have enough reference points and contextual understanding. And those are two, like contextual understanding and reference points are two different dynamic requirements to do good applied science. Mm-hmm. And to have those in place with a little bit of intuition to say, I think this is how it needs to fold for these circumstances, you know, for Red Bull Stratos, you know, for example.
Yeah.
And there was a moment where we didn't know. And so we had to kind of work through some of that stuff. And that was a moment where it eventually worked out to kind of get to the end of the story. He was successful and everything was good.
Put the link to the clip.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That will, it was a good experience. That leap when the stakes are that high, I think for all of us applied scientists and athletes that are trying to sort this thing out, it's like, do you really know your shit? And so that's when you can't all of a sudden zoom forward, you know, like I got a crash course on whatever this approach is and figure it out. Like you just have to have those reference points, which takes time, the contextual understanding, and then all of that science to be able to make an innovation, a required innovation. So that was a time that was really testing.
I was going to say, I imagine it takes a lot of reading of the athlete too, and the individual in front of you to be able to nudge and adjust them as they need, because it's going to be different if there was a different athlete or extreme athlete in that situation, I imagine, right?
Yeah, the relationship is foundational for psychology. And it's like been found to be somewhere around 60 to 70% of intervention effects is based on the relationship itself, which is phenomenal. So if you come in with the best tool, but you don't have any sort of connection, it usually doesn't work out. So to your point, yes.
And it seems to explain, I mean, if we kind of pivot to medicine and chronic disease, people who go to the doctor, unfortunately, are struggling with high blood sugars, high blood pressure, prediabetes. They only get 15 minutes with their doctor, and it's difficult for the physician to even be able to take on board all these things to build this relationship and then provide, you know, adequate direction when we talk about, you know, nutrition or sleep or, you know, mindset being such key pillars that we know now are important for these kind of things. And you know, I want to follow on what we were talking about with your athlete there and this concept that I hear, you know, I've heard you talk about for many years around personal philosophies and how we all have one, but if we're not actively participating in forming this personal philosophy, then a lot of all the subconscious thoughts and debris and junk that we thoughts that we all have can start to form your own personal philosophy for you. Can you unpack that a little more for us?
Yeah, there's two things in here. Let me pin that. Don't let me forget the core of your question, but you hit on something right before that I think is really powerful, is that when we are going to an expert, a medical provider or whomever, right? Let's just do the medical world for a moment. And it's 15 minutes. It's not enough. Mm-hmm. And so I'm classically trained as a psychologist, which means that we are trained to understand a cluster of symptoms represents likely this sort of diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So traditional medical models are working from a disease approach, a broken approach to say, what are the symptoms so I can categorize it so that I can, in my mind, I can pull down what best practices are for that symptom cluster, call it a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. In 15 minutes, if a doc doesn't take his pen out of his hand, me included, right? I don't work this way anymore. Like it doesn't take the pen out of the hand and really feel, and then to have a first principle to not diagnose, but to see and feel, then I'm not interested in that practitioner working with me. I like that they can categorize and clump and lump for speed and efficiency. That's great. That's really good to have a decision.
Emergency medicine. Very good.
Yeah. Efficiency medicine. And so that's cool. But I need personally as a, just speaking for me, Mike, I don't fit in boxes. Neither do you, Doc. Like we've got to, our bodies are local. Our minds are non-local. If you can get your arms around that for a minute, it's a cool concept. And then the symptoms aren't quite clean. So all I'm saying right now is that it takes time to really understand person. 15 minutes is the efficiency model, not the human flourishing model. Mm-hmm. And then, so from that point, if we slightly pivot over, time is expensive. So I get why we're in that model, right? I totally get it. But if we have the ability to sit with people that can afford like a real understanding of you, you will have better results in your life. And you won't box yourself into a set of symptoms or a cluster, you know, call it a diagnosis, or over-identify with the way the expert sees you. It is materially important that you first understand who you are. What are your guiding principles? And this is the segue into the core part of your question. If you abdicate and you allow the external world to over-index or influence in any way, really, who you are, it's a long road. It's a long life from a very stressful point of view, because each time you go into a new setting, you have to calibrate. What do they think of me? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's exhausting, right? And so we want to flip the model. And the most powerful people I know, the half percenters that are doing the thing that are changing sport, changing an industry, maybe changing the way we understand human potential, is that the external world does not influence their internal. And so they're working from the inside out. And so a personal philosophy is a fancy, like two word, you know, little hyphenated clause there to say, to shorthand, like, what are your guiding principles? What are your first principles in life? And if you don't know them, you're going to get whipped around. So let's do this first principle work and write that stuff down. And then the next part of that is like, if you can't get it out under duress, it's probably just an academic exercise. Mm-hmm. So like you want to be able to get those first principles at least intellectually clear and anchored. And then you want to practice them in such a way that they are as automatic as your signature of your, you know, your autograph. Like it's as automatic as you possibly can. And that's how this work comes to life.
And it is a daunting task, isn't it? I mean, because it's something that's dynamic and it's evolving and it's changing. So even in nutrition, so much of the work is mindset based and again, relationship based to get people to actually comply. And I've been surprised at, you know, the feedback or the progress people can make when they do lean into this, but even surprised at how some very successful people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, particularly men more so than even women, if I have to say, could be a little bit resistant or almost, you know, it almost takes them off guard to actually have to pause, zoom out 30,000 feet and really assess their own values versus just kind of chasing, doing, going, achieving.
Yeah, ditto. I understand. I agree 100%. Yeah. And I don't think though that there's a difference for the difference between the half percenters and the 0.01%ers. Like they're driving for this. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, this is great, you know, and they're not caught in the, sometimes they're caught in it, but they understand the difference between the treadmill type of life versus like this purpose driven, let me use my imagination to see the future as clearly as I can. And then let me back in all the capabilities, technical, physical, nutritional, mental, that I need to be able to have that future even be a shot, you know? So, and they also understand, Mark, that you're not even in the game if you don't know how your mind works. You're not even in the fucking game, honestly. So like you have to know how your mind works and how they work with emotions. And the difference between emotions and feelings, and to be able to have command of yourself in any environment, Jesus, like it's a prerequisite in that space.
Tremendous. And, you know, that whole discussion leads me into today's world where, you know, mental health is front and center and seemingly over the last decade, whether you're an early teen or middle age or older adult, you know, anxiety, depression rates are really going up across the board. And so it seems that obviously the focus of, you know, we've seen sleep science, nutrition science in the last decade, couple of decades really exploding. And now obviously mindset and mental performance has always been important, but seemingly in the last 5 years and or so, it's really become front and center in people's attention and minds. And, you know, in my practice, I see a lot of anxiety and depression increasing and in surprising situations, in situations where you might say, well, geez, this person has, you know, this job, this status, this success, you know, why might they be experiencing this? And I've heard, you know, another quote around this, maybe you can give us your take on, which is, you know, anxiety is when you don't live up to the expectations of others, and depression is when you don't live up to your own.
The way I think about anxiety in a most simplest form is that it's an excessive worry about what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. It's the word excessive is the important part. So anxiety is a clinical term that means something in the psychological professional world. Anxiousness and worry are, you know, non-clinical, mm-hmm. but they're subcomponents to have an anxiety attack or to be clinically clinically have anxiety. But essentially it's an excessive worry about later.
Yeah.
And it's either experienced like in your mind or experienced in your body. It's called somatic anxiety, and or both. Okay. So anxiety is future oriented. And then depression is it's more critical. And so depression is it's marked by three components. I suck, you suck, the world sucks. And then an underlying is always going to be like this. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm putting in the word suck for something else. Like, you know, I see the bad in you. I see the bad in me. I see the bad in the world. And, you know, I see the negative in you, the negative in me, the negative in the world. And it's kind of always going to be like this. So depression.
That last piece seems quite powerful, doesn't it? That it's always going to be like this component.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the hard part. And then it's experienced both mentally and physically as well. And then I say that because that's how I conceptualize the two. And then we don't have a psychological disorder that is not correlated with a sleep disorder. So there's not one, they're intimately linked. And so chicken and egg, I'm not talking in that order. I'm just saying the two are intimately linked. And then in this profession of sport and performance psychology, there's two components to it. There's the mental health piece. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the optimization and high performance piece. And so just kind of getting your arms around those two, there's a unique intersection between those two. They can live alone, but they rarely do.
Say continuum.
Both. Or... yeah, there's a continuum between the two. And the intersection is what I'm most interested in. Like high performance without well-being is unsustainable. It can happen.
Yeah.
You know, it can definitely happen. Well-being without performance, that can happen, you know? Yeah. Like, so I'm interested in that intersection that it's like a nested type of vibrancy that is so electric. It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that picture around anxiety of just sort of being frayed at the edges of, like you mentioned, underslept, over caffeinated, you know, glucose excursions, high and low through the day. We've got this individual who's just sort of burning the candle at both ends. And then we pick up on exacerbates these types of symptoms that you describe. And, you know, from a nutrition standpoint, it's always interesting because we tend to see, over 6 mg/kg of caffeine's going in. We're wondering why we can't sleep. We're consuming sugar right before bed because of the, you know, that constant stream of stress. And so from that angle, I'm always viewing my role as just being able to raise the playing field, because we're not going to be able to get into all the psychological areas that a psychologist or psychiatrist is going to be able to do. But it's always interesting how even just addressing some of those things seems to be able to raise the tide, if you will, to be able to better support some outcomes. I'm not sure, you know, what your experience is. Obviously, you mentioned having some experience with nutrition, how you integrate it, but interested to hear your thoughts on how all that holistic model really impacts some of these mental health conditions.
Yeah, I love what you're saying. And it's, you know, it is, humans are so multidimensional that as many evidence-based understandings as we can have, the better we can find solutions and the most efficient way through. And so, for example, if somebody is presenting with, let's say, performance anxiety and just kind of a little bit, a little too edgy, whatever, whatever, before competitions, and they're like, okay, well, let's take a look at things. And it seems to be like, and they haven't done a blood draw, or they haven't looked at, I don't know, tryptophan, tyrosine. They haven't looked at, you know, some basic stuff, then, or homovanillate, or they haven't looked at the stuff around that from a neuropeptide standpoint, like, oh, well, that would be an opportunity. And then it's, for me, it's not that different than asking them about sleep. And now that we've got decent, you know, consumer grade, sleep monitoring, decent, call it, that, we're starting to see decent assessments for, at scale for nutrition. And obviously if you can work with someone like yourself that has a full command and it's bespoke and customized, then that's where we really start. It starts to come alive. Yeah. And I like things. I like to understand like the neurotransmitter supports and systems. I also like to look at, C-reactive protein as an indicator of some stress. I like to look at oleic acid and ervonic acid, omegas. I like to look at those for like, what is the support mechanisms for neural firing? You know, so there's that type of stuff I'm interested in. I'm sure there's lots more that you would say is related to brain performance and psychological performance as well.
Hey friends, a quick note to let you know the fall 2023 Peak 40 coaching program is open for enrollment. If you're ready to make a change this fall, better energy, better mood, better sleep, weight loss, check out what 49-year-old Kevin was able to accomplish over his 12 weeks.
What impressed me about the Transform program was following a structured but flexible, easy to grasp plan grounded in nutrition fundamentals that I can rely on in the long term. Mark Bubbs' passion and expertise has equipped me with the tools to confidently manage my weight and seamlessly get back on track if life gets in the way. But I've lost 6 kilos in 12 weeks and maintained a weight lighter than when I got married 10 years ago. Job done.
You don't need to overhaul your routine to improve your health, your energy levels, and lose weight. The right small changes done consistently over time will yield some impressive results. Join us this fall for the 2023 Peak 40 Coaching Program group. That's training, nutrition, and lifestyle all included in the program. Just head over to drbubs.com/peak40 or email carly@drbubs.com, C-A-R-L-Y at drbubs.com for more details. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like you mentioned, around even the sleep technology. I mean, I always find it interesting that one of the biggest aha moments for clients is just seeing that, you know, after half a bottle of wine, their resting heart rate overnight goes from 60 to 85, right? So despite all the other bells and whistles that the technology provides, that's sort of one of the big moments that, you know, you've been telling your client to cut back for X amount of months, but now they can actually see it for themselves. And, you know, I don't want to take any red wine away from anyone on the weekends, but if we're doing it, you know, 6-7 nights a week, and we're struggling with sleep or mood and recovery, these kind of things, and it becomes a key area. And that,
how many hours for you does it take to process a 7-ounce glass of wine before it affects your sleep?
I've got 3 small kids at home, so I feel like how wine affects me now is much different than 10 years ago. I feel like if I even get past a glass, the next morning is, I can feel the sluggishness and, you know, the impact on deeper sleep, and the REM sleep starts to really rear its head a little bit for me.
I found 2 hours, you know, so like if I had a glass and then at about that 2 hour, if I have a glass, first of all, we should talk about intermittent, you know, in just a second, if you don't mind, but like two hours as a processing. So if I had 2 glasses, I need 4 hours before to at least process enough where it's not compromising sleep. And there's still a slight compromise, but not a rich compromise.
Yeah. And that's always the double-edged sword of, oh, I think I, starting earlier helps to then get better sleep. But if you don't stop, then all of a sudden you're at three or four glasses. Well, listen, that segues into talking about, you know, coaches' health, practitioners' health, frankly, anybody's health in midlife who's got a busy job, maybe kids at home. Because when you think of athletes and overtraining, we see things like low mood being a common symptom of overtraining. And for the rest of the coaches and practitioners and the rest of us in their 40s and beyond, it's the life load, right? It's the lack of sleep. It's the busy workplace. It's the kids and family commitments that then becomes difficult to recover from. And we see the similar symptoms of an athlete overtraining. We see the lower mood, lower libido, all these types of things. You know, coaches are great at providing that support to their group, but oftentimes we don't see them providing that support to themselves. And so I'm always wondering, you know, as someone who works in performance, what aspects can you convey to the performance staff, or how do you go about some of those conversations?
Okay. This is really important, because this is like, you know, when the teacher's tired, the students will notice that, you know. So over time, like you can get by for a little bit. But when we start to turn the gaze on the coaches of them being their very best from a psychological, physiological perspective, it is awesome. They love it. And making some of those changes is really hard as well for them. And so just starting with the basics, like, okay, what are you eating? What are the patterns of eating? Macronutrients first from your perspective. And then from my perspective, it's like more like, okay, how is sleep? You know, what are the thoughts that are working for you? Do you have any breathing strategies, you know, to help you through high stress experiences? And so, you know, like, when we turn the gaze on them, it's awesome. They love it. They eat it up. And sometimes they rigidly don't want to. There's an old model that, you know, in the NFL, that you got to get there at 6 a.m. and you're not a grinder unless you leave, you know, after 10. And so that's a long work day for 8 months straight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I guess they're chipping away at those types of things when the culture's set. It's really like swimming up, but, you know, swimming against the current pretty intensely, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. However, though, like I said, they want it. It's like when a coach is struggling, say they throw out their back or like a disc has slipped or something, I understand that the coach doesn't want to get on the table because that the athlete, you know, needs the work first. But if that coach is a distraction and a mess and his pain is getting in the way of him being able to sleep well and do good work and think well, like, we got to get him on the table. Same for psychology.
Awesome. And when you look at the future, you know, the evolution of mental performance over the next 5 or 10 years, what's got you excited in the research or things that are coming down the pipeline that are going to be the next evolution here? Because as mental performance is sort of taking center stage here as the next frontier, really, to really push forward.
I think what's taking place is the language is going to be more familiar and the practices will be more integrated. And so right now, even 20 years ago, you ask a coach or an athlete, like, how important is the mental part of the game? And they nod their head. Oh yeah. Yeah. This level. And then you say, you know, well, okay, so how much time in the day are we spending on the training of the mind? Like, what? You know, like, we're always doing it. Oh, really? Always? What do you mean by always? You know? And then when you drill into it, it's like, oh, well, we tell the guys they should do some imagery like at home. It's like, is that where you ask?
By always, it means never.
Yeah, that means never, you know, like, or the very special ones, you know? So anyways, the language is going to become more familiar and the sensitivity in that language is going to, you know, it's going to be great. And then how to practice training your self-talk or being calm. Your confidence is a skill that we can train. Imagery, blah, 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 fill in the blanks. Like, there's so many that will become. So I think what we're going to see is not necessarily like this mad rush to the frontier. We're going to see more of a foundational approach from pros all the way down to the youth and in between, the strata in between. We're going to see like it embedded more often, which is exciting.
Tremendous. And quickly, last one for you. With technology and obviously working with practitioners, it's such a complex space. how do we navigate that intersection? Because we can obviously learn so many skills through an app, but through this conversation, you know, talking about how it's to build that relationship is two thirds of the solution to be able to achieve some of these things. And so I always wonder, how do we sort of square that circle?
There are incredible technologies that are helping us advance human potential, and knowing how to, knowing the difference between a toy and a tool is really important. So practitioners knowing the difference and not thinking that something is a tool when actually it doesn't hold up to science. So there's a lot of toys that are presenting like tools from a cognitive performance standpoint. So noticing that difference, knowing that difference will be materially important. And if you don't know the difference, like have someone in your community that's what they know, you know, so that's important. The other piece that is exciting that I think is taking place is that we're having more honest conversations. So there's a first principle that I'll share with you that has been important to me, is that through relationships, we become. Mm-hmm. And so it's the relationships in this order, your relationship with yourself. So if you add that dimension of honesty, like having honest conversations with yourself, that's starting to happen more. Relationships with others and having honest conversations with each other about each other, that's happening more. We're becoming more sophisticated. Through relationships that we become, and the honesty of those conversations are the governor to your potential. If you're not honest with yourself, there's a governor on your potential. And that shit takes courage. And then same with other people. And I'll add this, just this last dimension, is that nobody does the extraordinary alone. So those relationships with others are materially important. And if they're not honest, we've got a governor on the potential of what we can do together. So I think that framework holds true.
Tremendous. I mean, great insights as always. Mike, really appreciate you carving out some time. I'm sure everyone knows how to get in touch with you, but what's the best place to stay connected and then listen to the podcast?
Yeah, man, I appreciate this conversation and the questions and introducing me to your community in this way. Thank you. Finding Mastery as a podcast on all the players. The website is findingmastery.net. And you can find about, you know, what we're doing in corporate environments and what some of the individual solutions we have for folks to train their mind. And so it's both of them. Yeah. So findingmastery.net. And then the social world is fun. Like it's awesome. Like we have fun on all the different platforms that way too.
Awesome. Listen, thanks again. I've always appreciated the time.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Well, listen, if you have any questions, love to hear from you. Reach out on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Dr. Bubs. Use the hashtag Peak40 so we can find those questions easily and use them on a future episode. And if you found this useful, please share with friends, colleagues, or anyone looking for Peak40 health and performance.
The Dr. Bubs Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubs Performance Podcasts.